And now, it's time for the Talk of the Northwest, the 9 to noon show with Greg Hughes on Highland Radio.
Hello and a very good morning to you. It is 5 minutes past 9 on this Thursday, which is the 13th of June. How are you all keeping? I do hope you're very well indeed. And you're welcome aboard for the next 3 hours where we will keep you informed and entertained. Okay, the lines are open for you right now if you want to get involved in the programme, raise an issue, comment on what we're talking about. WhatsApps and texts to 086 60 25000, 086 60 25000, and of course your voice notes can come into WhatsApp on that number as well if that suits you. Not everyone's fancies typing, or it suits them, or perhaps, you know, they don't want to or can't. So voice message, have your say that way. We want to hear from you. However, if you want to give us a call too, we've got Caroline on the phone lines, of course, as the show's producer, assisted by Shannon. 074 91 25000, you can get through to them. 074 91 25000. And if you want to email us, it's comments@highlandradio.com. Right, on to the newspapers this morning. Thursday, always a bumper day for papers. We'll start with the Tyrconnell Tribune. Their headline: crushing election blow for Fine Gael as Donegal's political parties analyse their votes in the local elections. The newly elected members will meet in Lifford next week to hammer out a pact to cover the next 5 years. New names, new agendas and priorities on the campaign trail, waiting urgently to be made into policy decisions. And there are changes, with Fianna Fáil losing 2 seats, Fine Gael are down to 3 members, and their share of the vote in Donegal has crashed to an all-time low of 10.5%. Sinn Féin held their 10 seats, while John O'Donnell's defeat cuts the strength of the independents to 9. But the story of the week has been the stunning success of the 100% Redress Party. They won 4 seats, but more importantly, they have a base of 7,400 first preferences on which to build a general election campaign, which might start needing to be built very, very soon, because we'll hear later on how an October general election seems to be in the offing. On to the Donegal News this morning. I threw everything at it. Niall Blaney is gracious despite defeat in the European elections. Despite a strong polling in Donegal with close to 15,000 first preference votes, about 20% of the total polled in the county, Fianna Fáil's Niall Blaney will miss out on a seat in the European Parliament. Although counting was still ongoing yesterday morning when he spoke to the Donegal News, it was clear that Senator Blaney was not in contention for one of the 5 seats. However, he said he was happy that he did everything he could. Now, counting is ongoing. We'll get an update from you there. It's still pretty tight for the 5th seat here in the Midlands Northwest region. And kind of interesting, just reflecting yesterday, I posted on social media, had quite a bit of response, some positive, some negative, but it was in relation to the decision by certain politicians not to canvass up here or to engage in the process. And it kind of irks me, because what MEPs will say to you is this: oh, well, we can't get on radio, no one cares about what's happening in Europe, blah, 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 blah. But they pick and choose themselves when they wish to speak to the media. And Barry Cowan, Michelle Gildenou, who else? Nina Carberry. They simply did not want to come on and debate on Highland Radio because they weren't debating in this area. And then it was pointed out to me as if it were a defence that, well, the reason they're not doing that is because the boundary is split and this is the norm. Of course it's the norm. But I presume if Nina Carberry was looking for votes, you would like a Maria Walsh 1 and then a Michelle Gildenou 2. I think the days whereby you just don't speak to large swathes of an electorate because of a pact to try and get people over the line, for me, that's, I don't like it. I think it should be dead and buried at this point. And yet we'll get press releases sent in because they'll want to speak to the people of the Northwest, the farmers, the fishermen, and whatever. And they'll go, well, why aren't you bringing me on the radio? Now, I'm not saying we're not bringing people on the radio, by the way. We speak to everyone equally. But ironically, I'll be thinking, well, you didn't want to speak to us in the run-up to the election. Why are we so important to you now? You're not being elected to represent the south of Midlands Northwest. You're seeking to be elected to represent all of it. And I think all of the candidates, if they're interested in our votes in the Northwest and our respect over the next 4 or 5 years, then they should have engaged with us. But anyway, that's that. I could be wrong. That's how I feel. But as I say, it would never influence us bringing people on into the future. That's not how we operate. The Dairy News this morning, a number of jobs are set to be axed at a dairy call centre, it can be revealed. First Source announced to staff on Wednesday the number of redundancies would be taking place. The company said that approximately 50 of the 63 affected employees live in the Derry area. I hope it's not a trend that we're seeing, you know, because I do know we talk about, sorry, we don't talk about, we sort of say, we generally accept that the country's at full employment. That's slowing down now. And there are just little stories that you're hearing about different employers about, you know, less work, laying people off. And I just hope that's not the next cycle that we're going into. I really do hope that is not the case. The Irish Times this morning, Green MEPs' hopes fade as party rounds on Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. The Green Party's hopes of salvaging sitting MEPs Grace O'Sullivan's seat in Ireland South were fading last night as the smallest of the coalition parties faced up to one electoral mauling, while its biggest partners in Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil enjoyed much better election results. The Greens' disappointment led to further criticism of Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil from Green Deputy Leader Catherine Martin yesterday. The counts were continuing in Cork and Castlebar last night, while it is hoped that Ireland South could conclude today Midlands North West, where Independent Ireland's Kieran Mullooly is likely to scrap for the last seat, with Sinn Féin's Michelle Gualdonu is expected to continue into tomorrow. Last night, as the counts continued, Luke Ming Flanagan, who's an independent, retained his commanding lead in Midlands North West, having garnered 89,660 votes after 14 counts. The quota in the constituency stands at 113,325. Now, the whole Green thing is quite kind of interesting because, you know, even say, for instance, during our debates, Lisa Chambers was very much sort of, I don't know, how could you say, critical of the Greens and policies in that regard. Others were as well. And I think the Greens have sort of taken the hit on that because it's not just in this part of the world, it was right across the country. And the Greens have become pretty toxic now because, of course, we had this green wave, didn't we? But now it seems that a lot of the negativities is being placed at the doorstep of the Green Party. So A, they've lost an awful lot of their representatives, but B, I think their time in government is over because I don't know how desperate you'd have to be. And I don't mean this is in any way offensive to the Greens, but how you'd have to be really, really desperate, I think, to go back into government with them again because there's a bit of a toxicity there amongst the voting public. I don't think they're going to have a very good general election, that has to be said. On to the Irish Independent. Obviously, a lot of the parties are reflecting on their weekend. Mary Lou McDonald's promise to rerun family and care referendums hurt Sinn Féin in the local elections, party members have said. A TD admitted campaigners were confronted on the doors by voters, while a councillor said voters told them, or told him, they would not vote for the party because of its stance on the referendum. Councillor PJ Carey said party leader Mary Lou McDonald's promise that the family and care referendums would not be run again, or sorry, wouldn't be run again, came up on the doors more than immigration. Sorry, they would be run again. There's a wee black mark there. But you see, at that time, and I remember that story, Pádraig McLaughlin was on with us saying, well, no, she never said that. But once it was out there and nothing could be done to sort of to take that back. Miss McDonald later backtracked on the promise. The public on the doors were annoyed. They told me they would not vote for Sinn Féin because of it, said Councillor Carey. I would say it was a mistake to suggest running a referendum again if you didn't get the favoured results. Maybe we're seen now as mainstream party. Maybe some felt a bit of resentment or anger over that. And the problem Sinn Féin face now and heading into a general election is to be seen to be the change or an alternative to Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. And that is the challenge that they have to face. And they don't have an awful lot of time to sort of sort that out because the messaging is going to have to become clear and refined and certain and unwavering. The Daily Mail this morning. Ukrainian refugees are under threat of being made homeless as the new 90-day limit on state-provided accommodation kicks in. The first Ukrainians to be affected by the 90-day limit, introduced on March 14th to reduce Ireland's pull factor as a refugee destination, were due to leave designated accommodation centres yesterday. One family who left their centre yesterday are understood to have found a home in pledged accommodation, a room in a private house or a vacant house, but more refugees who do not yet have anywhere to go are due to leave centres in Kildare and Limerick in the coming weeks. A source working with Ukrainian refugees said it is uncertain what is going to happen to dozens of people leaving designated accommodation centres over the next 2 weeks. They are under threat of being made homeless. That being said, I'm not sure how many arrived into Ireland once that 90-day limit kicked in, but those that did are going to be affected by that, we're told. The Irish Farmers Journal this morning: West of Ireland farmers are in line to receive a €15 million convergence boost, Department of Agriculture figures show. A department analysis of payments under the Basic Income Support for Sustainability shows the money is set to flow from 15 counties in the south and east to 11 counties, mainly in the country's western fringe as a result of the current cap. A detailed payment analysis obtained by the Irish Farmers Journal paints a clearer picture of the impact of 85% flattening. This confirms that Mayo, Kerry and Donegal will be the big winners, with BISS payments to these counties increasing by 3.2 million to 3.5 million or by 8% to 9%. So hopefully some of you out there are affected by that and will benefit. The Irish Daily Star this morning: independent Thomas Pringle has offered a bail surety at the High Court for a man wanted in the North to face a charge that he murdered an RUC officer nearly 50 years ago. Detective Sergeant Adrian Murray told the court yesterday that he arrested John Edward McNichol, who's 72, at the defendant's home in Newmills, Letterkenny. McNichols is alleged to have murdered RUC Constable Robert Lynn McPherson and to have attempted to murder a second RUC officer on July 26, 1975. Mr Justice Patrick McGrath consented to bail. The case will come before the court again on June 19th, and the hearing will take place on July 2nd. And that is a story that I, in my own time, want to dig a little bit deeper into to see how that, maybe someone out there knows, were letters of comfort issued to any of these people? Why are they not offered any sort of protection, in inverted commas, from the Good Friday Agreement? All stuff that in my own time I'd be interested to dig into. Right, the Irish Sun this morning, and it's labelled an exclusive, but it's a guess. The government is planning a general election the week before Halloween, we can reveal. Aides have penciled in Friday, October 25th, as they hope to cash in on an early September budget that will see billions doled out. It comes after Taoiseach Simon Harris helped Fine Gael to success in the local and EU elections, with Regina Doherty elected an MEP. But it has to be said that a reasonable local election does not necessarily make a general election a success. And finally, in the Irish Daily Mirror, another story from RTE. RTE could give a €400,000 redundancy payment to a staff member, but has refused to say who in Oireachtas Committee heard yesterday. Appearing before the Joint Committee on Culture and Media, new RTE chairman Terence O'Rourke also declined to say if the payment would be made to an individual who had refused to appear before the committee. 086 60 25,000 is the WhatsApp and text. I just want to reference as well, by the way, the Fab Four, another Irish track medalist. 4x400 girls take silver relay. Ireland's Fab Four of Sophie Becker, Rasadat Ardalecki, Phil Healy and Charlene Wardsley delivered a silver disc in Rome. Fantastic stuff. I didn't get to see that, but brilliant result for the ladies. Okay, we'll be back with more after we take a quick break. Stay where you are. Now, there's a new survey out which really only underlines the lived experience of many families across the Northwest, because we hear from them on a regular basis here. Grainne Morrison is a spokesperson for Families for Reforms, for Reform of CALMS, Child and Adolescent Mental Health Services. Grainne is with me now. Hiya, Grainne.
Hi, Greg. How are you?
I'm good. Right. Now, you surveyed 736 parents who whose child in some cases may be suicidal as they reach out to the CALMS services. What was the feedback, the headlines from engagement with all those parents?
Well, obviously quite startling, as we were expecting. What we in April, we set upon a survey, a mammoth survey of 80 questions. As you say, over 736 respondents came through. So the key findings were, you know, kind of, I suppose for every family, it was the difficulty at every stage of going through CALMS. The doors tended to be only opened if a child became critically unwell. There was a huge negative impact on families, you know, kind of from financial burdens to having to go down a private route. Additional steps often required, like going to an A&E, so a child presenting an A&E suicidal, or going to a local TD, or going down, as I said, the private route. What really came out was the lack of supports and interventions beyond medication, and the availability of interventions varies throughout.
And before we sort all of go through that, Grania, you mentioned the private route. Now,
yeah.
That is, I think, for the majority of people listening to us, no matter how you try and divvy up the income you might have coming into your house, is going to be a problem because it's incredibly, incredibly expensive. And it must be just so difficult for parents who might feel let down by the public services to then inquire what they can do for the child privately and look at the figures that would be required and say, we simply cannot do that. What an awful position for parents to find themselves in. Can you give us an idea of the cost of going down the private route?
Absolutely. So at minimum, for an assessment, a private assessment in Ireland would cost €700 and then €150 for every appointment then after that. And that's at minimum. You can go from anything from €750 to €2,000. So it's for a lot of families, it's non-reachable. And in fact, one of the recipients, and I'm quoting her here, saying, it breaks my heart to think of what kind of life she could have had if she wasn't thrown out on the scrap heap because her parents couldn't afford an earlier diagnosis. Maybe that could have made a difference. We will never know. Like, that's startling, mm-hmm. You know, kind of how it affects families. It's huge. And a lot of our families, you know, kind of a lot of parents would have to leave work. The respondents came in, 33% of families members had to leave employment. 32% of those had to take unpaid leave, and 16% are on carers leave. So that's massive.
So what is there's no typical journey, but what would be something that we'd expect to happen, a journey for a family in engaging with CALMS? So they're at home and the child or the young person is unwell, mentally unwell. So at what point would they sort of engage with CALMS? Would the GP reference them and say, you know, your child probably needs some state mental health services, so I'm going to refer them to CALMS? And then explain that, and then, Grania, if you can pick it up after that, sort of the likelihood is this is not like a broken leg that just sits there as a broken leg, okay? Often a child may continue to deteriorate whilst waiting to see someone. So can you talk us through an example of someone's experience?
So again, we surveyed this and, you know, kind of found that it was very unlikely. It was maybe 40 to 50% of children would be accepted on the first referral. And that would be, you know, kind of in Donegal alone, you've got, in CH1 alone, the waiting list, the Maskey report came out, the waiting list was 35 days for suicidal intent, 80 days for suicidal ideation, 60 days, these are all days, for eating disorders. And for deliberate self-harm would be 60 days. So that's, you know, kind of, these are children that are critical, and that's how long it's, you know, taking them
to
see them.
If there's a young person who is saying that they are thinking about suicide, or it's crossing their mind, or it's in their mind, and they're referred, it could be 80 days at least before they see someone in CALMS.
Yes, and that's in CHO1.
That's our area,
catchment area. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that was figures that from the Maskey report there last year.
That's scary. It's very, very, very worrying.
You can imagine if you were a parent or a child.
Yeah, And as I said too, whilst sitting on these waiting lists, Grania, in many cases too, the condition of the young person can worsen.
Absolutely, 92%. And I'm sorry, I'm talking in stats and figures because I hate this. There's a child behind every one of these stats. But 92% of the families responded that their child's mental health deteriorated whilst waiting for support from CAMHS.
And there's two things that's going on for me in this, in that obviously you have that immediate support that really needs to be there, Grania. But the longer someone goes, I think, without support or intervention, firstly, the potential for a very, very bad outcome, but also, too, it carries on into their adult life and as they get older, too, because we're not seeing them and helping them early enough.
That's totally, it's totally true. And, you know, kind of we wonder why we have such a mental health crisis in Ireland. And we wonder why we have such a high suicide rate. I think in our 18 to 25 year old male population, we have the highest suicide rate in Europe. Mm-hmm. So early intervention is key. And I know it's the buzzword, but it's absolutely and utterly key.
And if I could just add a comment to this, Grania, because it often comes in, say, for instance, when we're talking about all the attention that's given to fatal road traffic collisions, and quite rightly so, and no one's saying we shouldn't do that. But then people go, well, there's another problem here as well, a significant problem, and that is the rate of suicide. Why aren't we seeing action on this? Why aren't we seeing plans on that? But the bottom line is, Grania, I think the reason we don't is because, say, for instance, they were government-sponsored, it would eventually come back to, you know, the problems right back here at the very beginning where we're not actually getting in early intervention to help people.
Absolutely.
So you bury it. You just don't talk about it. You leave it under the carpet.
Absolutely. And that's the sad thing about it. The problem is multifaceted, you know, kind of, and a lot of the problems are, a lot of the children that are seen in CAMHS would be neurodivergent. And what I'm saying about, or what I mean about to define neurodivergent is a child who is either autistic or ADHD or dyslexic or dyspraxic. Mm-hmm. They would be the highest. And those, as we see early on, you know, kind of through the AON process, you know, the roadblocks that are going through that as well. So it is a multifaceted problem. But, you know, kind of talking about CAMHS, this is crisis. You know, kids are getting to crisis stage and kids, you know, the data suggests that autistic kids would be 28 times more likely to die by suicide than their neurotypical peers. That's horrendous.
And this is not something we're reflecting on back 80 or 90 years ago and saying it was a failure and we should have done this and we should have done that. We're living through this right now. At the same time, we're seeing record levels of young people ringing the likes of Childline and other services, record levels of children, very sadly, that are the victims of abuse, be it from, you know, adults or peer-to-peer. You know, we can't. There comes a point where we can't stand back and sort of not see this for the absolute tragedy that it is. I mean, we're living in it right now. And I think we as a society should be more angry about this. You know, I hear an awful lot, and I understand it, and I'm saying it's wrong, about what threats may be coming to children or what that our children may become unsafe for whatever reason. I'm not getting into that. And yet here we have this dire, dire situation that's all of our own doing and really in our control, and no one's talking about that, or not enough people, I don't think, are talking about it, except the families that are having to live this nightmare on a day-to-day basis, left alone, struggling, seeing their young people get worse in the house, wondering, you know, I'm probably afraid to leave them for 5 minutes on their own even.
And you know, kind of, we've had, you know, kind of reports from families saying that CAMHS are telling them to take sharp objects away from them, you know, kind of, so... It's so sad. It's so sad in a country that's awash with money. And, you know, kind of politicians have the power and can change this. The Maskery report has, you know, kind of issued a huge amount of mental health, you know, forms. The committee on the Oireachtas Committee for Children Integration recommended there in May $50 million to be instantly given to CAMHS. So we'd ask government to engage and, you know, to prioritise reform.
Is this, if I was speaking to a government representative, and in these cases we always do invite just for balance and fairness, yeah. Grainne, would they say, look, we've pumped in millions into this, there's no end of money going into this area, but it's about recruitment of staff and all that kind of stuff? Do you know what I mean? Because often that's where these conversations end up being. Or is more money required? And if that money were allocated, then we would see these waiting times reduced.
Yeah, well, you know, kind of, there's definitely more money required. CAMHS is very much understaffed. And, you know, kind of, I talk about CAMHS and people think, you know, kind of staff are, you know, very vulnerable as well. There's in our survey, there was staff members, it was highlighted that only four certain staff members that children came through their times in CAMHS. But staff are vulnerable, you know, kind of, they're tired, they're exhausted, they're not paid enough. And there's a government, or there's a HSE embargo on staff at the moment. So people aren't being recruited into posts. You know, kind of the Psychiatric Nurses of Ireland, I believe, are taking action. So I know money is a problem, but there's money in the country. It can be given, you know, kind of to CAMHS to help. At the minute.
Well, the government would say they've invested 1.3 billion euro in mental health services. In April, they said there were 12% more CAMHS appointments offered to children and young people last year. Waiting lists for CAMHS services continue to fall. Nearly 500 fewer children waiting by the end of 2023. And then they say the funding will be spread more geographical. Like 1.3 billion euro is a huge investment. It would make you wonder a little bit, like the health service, if that money's being administered correctly. But do you recognise that there has been a 12% increase in appointments for children in 2023, that waiting lists continue to fall?
I would love to see how they calculated those waiting lists and what key performance indicators they used to identify it. Because if they used, and what our families are seeing, that our autistic kids are being discriminated against in CAMHS, and a lot of families couldn't get into CAMHS. They were told either your child is autistic, look for support in CDNT. CDNT might come back and say your child is too anxious for us, you need to go back to CAMHS. And then the difference, again, the MASCA reports for CHO1, per capita funding last year was €78.80, whereas in CHO7, it's €125.50. Mm. So there's a vast difference in monies allocated.
So are you, just to be clear, and I don't want to be misreading your comments, it seems the most complex cases are passed from pillar to post. Is that because a lack of expertise in joined up thinking, or are the services taking cases that are easier to resolve? Do you get where I'm coming from? I'm just wondering, is the system not set up correctly to properly deal with complex cases, or are they being purposely discriminated against because it clogs up the system or something like that there? It's a crude question, but I'm just trying to get to the bottom of it, Grainne.
I'm, to be honest with you, I don't know. But the figures that we have would suggest that there might be some handpicking of cases.
Right, that's the question. Yeah, that's what I was asking. That's worrying.
So,
Okay. Right, Grainne, listen, thank you very much for your time. Sorry if I took up too much of your time. I know you're busy this morning. Have a lovely day, please.
Thank you, Greg, and thanks very much for having us.
Bye.
Take care.
Bye-bye. Grainne Morrison, spokesperson for Families for Reform of CAMHS. Now, five fishing organisations, Irish fishing organisations, have come together. There's three based in Killybegs, by the way, and we're going to speak to a rep of one of those. They've come together to call for change of representation at EU level. We're joined by Brendan Byrne, CEO of the Irish Fish Processors and Exporters Association. Brendan, good morning to you. Thanks for your time.
Good morning, Greg.
Right, so it's not insignificant, is it, that really the industry, the representatives of that industry are coming together now and speaking with one united voice? It's really quite significant, I think.
It is very significant, and I suppose it speaks to the situation we're now facing, the challenges that the entire Irish fishing sector, from the smallest inshore vessel to the largest vessel offshore, from the fish retailer to the fish factories. We're all facing the greatest challenges of our time post-Brexit, also the historic unfairness of successive policies that have come from the EU that has led us to a juncture now that our sector is really under massive pressure. We're fearful of the future, but yet we're surrounded by the richest fishing grounds in all of Europe, fishing grounds that other countries can successfully derive a living from. So we're both fearful of the future, but we're also respectful of the fact that we have the greatest asset of all. And from that, we believe we can develop a future that will increase jobs and opportunity for our coastal and maritime communities.
But the solution to this is simple, is it not? Is that next time quotas are being divvied up, that Ireland gets its fair share representing the industry in this country and its importance, and also the fact that these are our waters we're talking about. Yes, we're part of a union, but we have to be fairer. That's really what it comes down to. Maybe I'm simplifying it too much.
Well, in reality, it does come down to quotas, but historically, the various deals that set up the common fishery policies of 1983 and the relative stability keys that have locked in the shares that other countries have in our waters is going to be much more difficult in the medium term to unravel. But that is the ultimate aim, that we get greater fairness and greater opportunity in our own waters. We're minority shareholders in the waters that surround this island. We catch 15% of the fish, whereas our EU colleagues are allowed to catch 85%. That's grossly unfair, but there's a lot of historical unraveling of that. But where we are with the five fish and representative bodies is we have come together collaboratively. We have said that we will work constructively, proactively, with all parties, with the government and the department, in developing a strategy that will work both nationally and at European level. The reality is we are facing the challenges of our lifetime, and we need to come about the solutions to this in a much different way than what we have for the last 20 years, because the last 20 years have spelled nothing, only failure.
A thing too that beggars belief for me is that we're over here sort of battering away trying to get a fair share, and others have been given a share of these quotas and simply don't use them. If I'm correct in saying so, and they're just there, they're sitting there, right? We're unable to take more fish from our waters. And someone somewhere has negotiated a deal that obviously has given them more than they either use or want.
That is correct. The historical unfairness of the common fishery policy has, in some cases, some of our member states leave more fish uncaught than we're allowed to catch in the first instance in some species. But that is the reality of how unfair this policy is that was set up in 1983. It was never reformed in any meaningful way since then. It has allowed large member states in the fishing industry, such as the Dutch and the Belgian, the French and the Spanish, to develop at a time where we are constantly in decline. But we're now at a juncture where, unless we do a radical approach collaboratively involving the fishing industry, all of the fishing industry and the government of the day and our department, unless we coalesce quickly, within 2 years, our industry will be decimated. That is the challenge that we are facing. That is why...
But how do we achieve that, though, Brendan? You see, because... I daren't think how long it is now, 10, 15, 20 years I've been doing interviews on this, and the messaging is often the same. Now, obviously, you would hope this is different because we're seeing these associations and organisations coming together, right? But the language seems familiar. It seems that we're getting a raw deal, we need more, we're on the brink. What can change this time to change the outlook for the industry?
Well, the greatest advantage we have now is that three of the five organisations that have come together collaboratively have new CEOs. There is new and fresh thinking. Secondly, post-Brexit, the reality has finally dawned in Ireland that for 20 to 30 years, we never had a pro-industry, pro-fishing, pro-sector policy from the successive governments that have been in office over that period. We also, thankfully, have changes within our Department of Fisheries and Marine. And finally, we have a department that is willing to develop the sector, is willing to fight for the sector, both nationally and European level.
Mm-hmm.
We are a sector that has suffered greatly from the lack of change within the organisation, so from lack of change within the department and the total lack of change of successive governments in terms of policies that work. If you compare and contrast us to other EU states, be it the Netherlands, Denmark or Spain, they have policies that actually work. They go to the heart of Europe to fight for fishing. We're on the periphery, yes we are, but we have the asset that the others are developing and progressing from, and that is the availability of fish in abundance around our island. This isn't rocket science, but what it is a clarion call for cohesion and collaboration. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, divided, we will fail.
And I get that, right. So say that part's in place, and it's fantastic to see that. Is the reality not, though, you could arrange a meeting amongst all five CEOs with Minister Charlie McConnellogue, and he could sit down in Killybegs and he could listen to everything that you say, and he says, I agree, and I'm going to go to Europe and I'm going to put up a very strong fight for the industry here. And then the CFP comes around again. We get the crumbs off the table. We might get some increases in one fish stock or other. And you know, nothing fundamentally has changed to the extent that it might actually save the industry. Do you get where I'm coming from? Like, so what in that process has to change or possibly could change that this amalgamation, this cooperation could actually yield results? Because it all eventually just filters through the one person, really.
It's more in depth than that, although I accept the point you make. What I'm talking about in terms of deep collaboration is that the department, the industry, through the collaborative body here, and the minister are all of one mindset, all of one plan, and are working collaboratively. As we know, the European model is based on lobbying, it's based on the parliament, it's based on the commission and the national governments and the ministers and the departments. If we collaboratively work together, and this is unprecedented, it may sound illogical that we haven't gone to this mm-hmm. place before, but this is the place we are now. And what we're offering and what the government, I think, are open to is that we all work together, because we have allowed our industry to go to such a point and such a juncture of failure that we have to radically reset how we engage with the Commission, with the Parliament, with DG Mara at technical level, which involves our department, at political level, it involves our minister, and at lobbying level, it involves us as industry, all of one mind and one plan.
But this would actually require also, though, and listen, fantastic, I'm behind you all the way, this would actually require, would it not, this plan to be effective, an effective reform of the common fisheries policy. So reforming a very significant policy that spans the entire EU and a couple of countries that aren't even in the EU. It's ambitious and it's bold, but that is what's required. Can it be achieved? And what I'm trying to get at here is, what level of commitment do you need from the government for this to work?
We need the same level of commitment from the government of the day and the department of the day as we ourselves in industry are given it. And that is full and complete commitment to saving and fighting for the Irish fishing industry. Whereas the common fishery policy reform is key and central, there will and there are other opportunities that present themselves in terms of fishing opportunities, in terms of quota, that are outside the common fishery policy. What we're advocating is that Ireland gets new and radical in its approach for fishing. And that means every opportunity that comes forward at EU level, we're on top of it. Every opportunity that comes forward, we're in there saying, hold on a second, you guys are benefiting from the waters around Ireland. It's time you heard and listened to Ireland.
Yeah, I think that argument would be strengthened, and this is no commentary on the person who's in that position at the moment, but fishing being recognised and a minister with specific responsibility for fishing. I think I put that to the head of the KFO before, and he didn't seem to think that that was terribly significant. Maybe you can, or sorry, it wasn't actually vital to this, but for me, I imagine if you send someone over there that's specific, has a specific role in a specific area, surely as part of this wider initiative, that sends maybe a stronger message to the EU. Are you of the mind that it doesn't matter if we have a specific minister for fisheries or not?
Well, every sector would want a minister of their own. Of course, it's natural for the Irish fishing industry to say, yes, we want a minister of our own. Whether that ever comes into fruition would be a matter for the Taoiseach of the day. So the reality is we have a minister for agriculture, food and fisheries at present. We're content to work with him in terms of this plan and in terms of other opportunities that will present themselves. If a future government in the future wants to put in a minister for fisheries, we will welcome that. But the reality is where we are, and where we are is that we need to engage more proactively at European level. That also involves looking at who our permanent representatives at European, at technical level, are that are dealing with fisheries. If you compare us to other member states, our office in terms of how we engage at fishery levels is very small. It shouldn't be. We have the largest territorial fishing grounds in Europe. So therefore, we should have a very strong, robust, resilient team at the core of decision making at Europe. That's not the case now, and it hasn't been the case for the past 20 years. We're talking about key and fundamental things that are needed if a sector is to develop and progress. Europe is key and fundamental in development of fisheries. Okay. So therefore, we need to go to the very heart of it, and we need to be strong at the heart, and we need to be united at the centre of decision-making in Brussels.
Yeah, OK. So if I'm reading it correctly, then obviously what an MEP says or does, or what particularly what a minister does, you're saying really that it's the ongoing every day, every week meetings, the negotiations, the hard conversations that aren't necessarily political. That's really where we need to improve things, that we need to become a thorn in the side, and that the views of your groups and others, it's a shared view sort of at civil servant level, really. Not when we talk about it, when all the decisions have been made.
We need to reset the entire engagement and dial tone that Ireland is sending into the Commission or into the Parliament or into technical level. There's so much more than just meetings in Brussels. The meetings behind the scenes, the meetings within the technical level, is where decisions and bartering is made. And that's where I feel for the last 20 years we've been at our weakest. So this collaboration is a collaboration of industry, it's a collaboration with government and the department, but it's also a reality check that we need to get stronger in Europe. And our agenda is very simple. We're going to be proactive. We're going to be constructive. And we are very, very clear. The Irish fishing industry has a good and bright future because we have the raw product. We have the asset that can develop that. We need now to align industry, the political arm, the technical arm, in order to get to where we are, rather than the challenges that we have been facing for the last 10 years, but most particularly the challenges that we are experiencing post-Brexit.
Just one other thing, and maybe you know and maybe you don't. I found it quite curious that quotas were allocated to countries and went unused. And I was trying to find out sort of what fish we're talking about here. Do you know what I mean? What fish affect us? And there's an awful lot of species of fish, right? But I could only find data on 5 or 6 species of fish. Now, I'm not sure if that data is absent or I simply couldn't find it. But what it made me think is, do we actually know what's going on? Do we know what is being effectively wasted that we don't have access to? There doesn't seem to be, you know, a full set of figures there that we could actually work on and say, no, we want this and we want that and we want the other. I could be as far out, but I just couldn't find that data.
Well, it's very difficult to get data of that nature readily available from the EU, but the Minister McConnellogue set up a working committee on the reform of the CFP, and we obtained some data from Europe that showed 8 or 9 species of fish from Monk to Haddock to Hague that, if the Irish fleet were allowed to catch, would help the resilience and help the profitability of the fleet. And yet these are left on catch year in, year out by other countries. So what you have is a 40-year-old policy that has never been reformed based on a track record between 1976 and 1983, when probably Ireland was at its weakest in terms of fishing, and whereby I think we certainly missed the boat, and pardon the pun, when we set our own limits to quotas when we submitted our catching records to the EU. There's a lot of historical failure, but we're not looking back here. We're looking forward at a future whereby we can say that our industry will be resilient. It will have a future for our young fishermen and fisherwomen. And that is the plan. This is bold, it's new, and it's innovative. We need buy-in from the Minister of the day. We need buy-in from the department. And we need a commitment that Ireland is going to put fishing front and centre so that in 20 years' time, when you and I are still talking, we will have a robust industry that's employing 3 to 4 times what it currently is.
Thanks, Brendan. Take care of yourself.